I've learned one thing. When you're starting a conference, you start on time and you finish on time. That was the key rule. Je sais qu'il y a des gens qui arrivent, mais on a dit on commence à 7 heures, alors on commence à 7 heures pour qu'on finisse à 9 heures. Bonsoir mesdames et messieurs, mon nom est Annie Demirjian, au nom de l'École d'affaires publiques et internationales de Glendon. Ça me donne un très grand plaisir de vous accueillir au débat de l'ALENA. Nous avons vraiment des conférenciers exceptionnels et nous remercions à l'avance à leur participation. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the Glendon School of Public and International Affairs, it gives me a great pleasure to welcome you to the conference on North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, a very timely discussion, I would say. We have some exceptional speakers tonight, and we thank them for accepting our invitation to participate at our event. But before we start the proceeding, let me first acknowledge our presence on the traditional territory of many indigenous nations who have and continue to call this territory home, including Haudenosaunee Confederacy, Anishinaabeg Nation, the Huron-Wendat, and the Métis Nation. We also acknowledge our presence on the territory of Mississauga of the New Credit First Nation. I would also like to acknowledge the presence of Ms. Anne Chechadri, from the Consul General of the United States. I know she is to participate. She will be joining us at a later date, at a later time. Avant qu'on commence la conférence, j'aimerais inviter notre partenaire qui l'a depuis le début de notre conférence, qui a participé avec nous, qui est le président du Conseil canadien international, pour prendre la parole. I would like to invite our partner, the president of the Canadian chapter for the Canadian International Council, Mr. Fraser Mann, to say a few words. And I would really like to thank Fraser simply because he has been encouraging us at this conference from day one. So, Fraser, please join me.
Thank you very much, Annie, and it really is a pleasure to be here again. This is the fourth time, I think, that we've been together at the Glendon Global Debates, and the Canadian International Council, and particularly the Toronto branch of the Canadian International Council, is really pleased to be joining with the Glendon School of Public International Affairs to sponsor these events, and certainly the event this evening, which I'm sure you all agree is extremely timely. So I'm very much looking forward to the very informative discussion that I'm sure we're going to have. And I know from my members, and I know it's the same with the people from Glendon, there are always lots of really good questions. So I'm sure I won't be disappointed this evening. Just to say a few words about CIC. CIC has been in existence for almost 90 years. It'll be 90 years in 2018. So we've been around for a long time under other names. Canadian Institute for International Affairs, I think, was the original name. And we're a national nonpartisan organization devoted to the study of international affairs and Canada's place in the world. And we have 15 branches across Canada, including the Toronto branch, of which I'm president. We have a new national president. We have a new national website, thecic.org. We have a number of events in Toronto. The national office also organizes various events. So I really encourage you to join if you're not a member already. There are some forms at the front that you can pick up on your way out. And I should point out the student membership fee is really low. So I really encourage you, if you're a student, to join and become part of our organization. So again, welcome. And again, thank you, Annie and Marion and all the great people at Glendon for all the work that you do in putting this event together. And as I say, I'm really looking forward to the discussion with our great panelists this evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Fraser. And before I turn to the moderator, I would like to really thank the Glendon Master Conference Interpreting Graduate School students who are providing the simultaneous translation tonight. Meanwhile, can I ask those of you who have the écouteur to please turn the volume down? You'll still be able to hear the experts, but you won't be disrupting your neighbors. So please turn the volume down. Et maintenant, ça me donne un très grand plaisir de vous présenter le modérateur ce soir. I would like to introduce the moderator tonight, Mr. Sam Billard, a senior partner at Ayres & Berlies. I read his CV. I could stand here for 10 minutes to tell you. He's a very senior expert. Indeed, comes with not only legal background, having completed his MBA, has worked in the international finance, international system, international trade in Ontario, Canada, IMF, the Caribbean, and the list was extremely long, definitely in the international trade, and has published extensively around the world. Mr. Billard, you have the toughest job right now, and I'm turning the conference over to you. Avot.
Well, thank you, Annie. Hopefully I can live up to those pronouncements. Good evening, everybody, distinguished guests and ladies and gentlemen. I have the honor of moderating this debate on the political implications of the NAFTA renegotiations. The title moderator suggests that there might be something immoderate about the debate or the debaters that will need to be moderated in some way so that the debate can continue in a civilized fashion. I doubt that there is anything immoderate about your panel tonight, although I do understand that the Honorable Conrad von Finkenstein can be a handful. There can be no doubt that there is a lot at stake in these talks from an economic perspective, although the nature of the economic impact is unclear. I heard Jerry Diaz, who is the national president of Unifor, the union representing Canadian auto workers, and is an advisor to the Canadian negotiating team on Information Morning the other day. He was talking about the 50% U.S. content requirement recently introduced by the U.S. negotiating team. He said that this was clearly a non-starter, that the U.S. did not want a deal, and that NAFTA was finished. He was optimistic about that failure, and he thought it would be good for Canada and for Canadian auto workers because it would stop the migration of jobs to Mexico. He seemed to feel that the U.S. would not want to destroy the agreement with Canada, so there would be some turmoil, but ultimately all would be well. Pretty impressive level of optimism there. On the other hand, there's an article in the Globe and Mail this morning that the CMHC sees a 31% drop in housing prices from a wave of anti-globalization that leads to widespread protectionism and increased tariffs. The CMHC granted that this would be an extreme result, but we are seeing extreme talk here. And a lot of it seems to be rather spectacularly uninformed. In the wrap-up to the fourth round of the NAFTA negotiations, Chrystia Freeland, our Minister of Foreign Affairs, accused the U.S. of trying to turn back the clock on 23 years of predictability, openness, and collaboration under NAFTA. I'm quoting that. Thought that was particularly apropos. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, in return, rebuked Canada and Mexico for not being more open to the U.S. goal of reducing its trade deficits and migrating more jobs to the U.S. Why anyone would expect Canada or Mexico to willingly participate in such a project is beyond me, but then President Trump appears to have thought that Mexico would fund a wall he was thinking of building. The economic stakes are high, and so are the political pitfalls. No politician wants to preside over the impoverishment of his or her constituency. But what to do in the face of the bully president, as the song says, do we stay or do we go? So we had a conference before the conference, and we decided that Conrad von Finkenstein would speak first because he has the most experience. So I'll start with an introduction of Conrad. Conrad is currently an arbitrator for domestic and international business disputes, but that, for him, is retirement. He is described by Wikipedia as a Canadian civil servant, which is laughably abrupt for a career like his. He was senior legal advisor to Simon Reisman in the original negotiations of the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, which preceded NAFTA. He oversaw the implementation of NAFTA as a senior legal Canadian legal advisor. He helped draft the currently controversial Chapter 19 of NAFTA relating to the resolution of trade disputes among the NAFTA parties. He has also been Commissioner of Competition for Canada, a Justice of the Federal Court of Canada, and Chairman of the CRTC. His resume goes on and on. Born in Germany and educated in Canada, Conrad is noted for his analytical skills and his logical and public-minded approach to the problems he addresses. I do not think President Trump would claim or admire any of those skills. Second will be Laura Dawson, who has direct knowledge of these talks because she actually lives in Washington. Laura is the director of the Canadian Institute of the Wilson Center, an independent research organization chartered by the U.S. Congress in memory of Woodrow Wilson, a most un-Trumpian president. Born in Sault Ste. Marie, Laura was raised in Calgary and received her post-secondary education in British Columbia and Ottawa. A self-confessed trade geek, she has been an advisor to the American Embassy in Ottawa and is a prolific speaker and writer on trade. She's also a fundraiser for the Canadian Institute. So if you've got a few dollars hanging around, you might give it to her.
Phone lines are open.
Dr. Dawson is admired for her work ethic and her ability to make the intricacies of international trade understandable to ordinary people. So hear, hear. And last to speak will be Stephen Wise, because Stephen is a negotiation expert. Stephen is Associate Professor of Strategic Management / Policy at the Schulich School of Business of York University and current Acting Director of the Center for Global Enterprise. He was born in the USA, but traveled widely in his youth. He received his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania, which is, coincidentally, Donald Trump's claimed alma mater. The university is silent on this matter.
That's true.
But that august institution is proud to claim Dr. Wise as a graduate. Dr. Wise is admired for his educational skills. He has won awards for those skills from his students, who are the most reliable critics, and for his innovative case study relating to the acquisition of pandas by the Toronto Zoo, which was a great international negotiation coup. So without further ado, I will turn the podium over to the Honorable Mr.
Thank you very much, Sam, for that generous introduction. I didn't know Clendon College existed until I was invited here. Today was the first time I was here, and I walked before through this wonderful campus, and I must say it's a very hidden jewel in Toronto. I'm delighted to speak here to you about my experience in negotiating with the U.S. My experience was based on a U.S. free trade agreement, NAFTA. I don't know what's going on in Washington right now any more than what I read in the paper or what you read in the paper. I'm not part of the negotiations. But I doubt that the structure, the way the U.S. approaches it, and the way the negotiations are conducted are any different. What is probably different is the noise that accompanying it and the comments from the side by Mr. Trump. But the underlying structure is probably the same. So let's start with Canada. When we negotiate a free trade agreement or a trade agreement, we do a lot of preparatory work. For the free trade agreement, we had a Royal Commission. We have studies. We have interdepartmental consultations. We really work very carefully on trying to figure out what is our strategy, what are the games, why would we do it not? I remember, for instance, when we decided to do a free trade agreement with Chile, why Chile, et cetera, and it was basically driven by the mining interests that Canada had in Chile, the interest that we had in making sure that our companies could take advantage of the rich resources there, and by the same token, for the Chilean, we were basically a step before this to do something with the U.S. It was sort of a backdoor entry to making themselves a legitimate partner. And it worked for both of them. But there was a clear-cut strategy on both sides, and we worked it. And of course, we execute that strategy the way we normally do. Cabinet decided, it becomes a policy. Public service then gets engaged in doing it. Once an agreement, it is, gets approved, it's signed by the government, we have enacting legislation, and it then becomes law. So a very orderly, straightforward process. In the US, it's nothing of the sort. First of all, notwithstanding everybody who talks about Trump and the administration, trade is not his remit. It's Congress that's in charge of trade, not the administration. And it's absolutely crystal clear in the Constitution. Section 8 says the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, and imposts and excises, and shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations. Right? There can't be any ambiguity here. It's Congress that's in charge, not the administration. Now, obviously, Congress personally can't negotiate, can't do the thing, so the administration does it on behalf of Congress. And over the years, has been evolved a methodology for doing it. It used to be called fast-tracked, it's now called trade, TPA, Trade Promotion Authority. The formal name is actually Trade Promotion and Accountability Act. So that just is, it's normally known as Trade Promotion Authority. But what it does, in the words of the USTR, TPA does not provide new powers to the executive branch. TPA is a legislative procedure written by Congress through which Congress defines U.S. negotiating objectives and spells out a detailed oversight and consultation project for during trade negotiations. Under TPA, Congress retains the authority to review and decide whether any proposed U.S. trade agreement will be implemented. So this is USTR, the administration conceding the power is with Congress, they do it, and we have a mechanism by which we actually execute their power. Essentially, there are five steps involved. The act is very long and complicated in procedure, but the act in long detail sets out the priorities for trade negotiation, all in general terms, nothing specific. Then the president can give notice that he wants to negotiate. Then the negotiations ensue, but they are subject to extremely onerous reporting requirement and consultation requirements, which are still spelled out in painstaking detail. Then the draft agreement has to be presented to Congress 6 months beforehand, then follows the legislative process. Then Congress votes it up or down, this agreement that has been negotiated. And then once if it is voted in, the president signs it. Now, these consultation and reporting requirements are formalized to agree that we have never seen in Canada, we wouldn't and wouldn't probably do it, and it is really mind-bogglingly complicated. It says, for instance, to create trade policy, the USTR has to consult with the Senate Finance Committee, the House Ways and Means Committee, the leadership of the Senate, and the leadership of the House, and seven committees on both sides, from the Committee on Appropriation, on Agriculture, on Banking, on Commerce, on Foreign Relations, on Judiciary, and on Small Business. And then there are reporting and consulting requirements. And first of all, every member has access to the negotiating text and to provide access to set text for his staff. Secondly, the USTR has to provide 60 days before signing them a detailed US proposal throughout. USTR has to create a transparency officer whose whole function is to negotiate, to deal with Congress. USTR has to meet and consult with any member of Congress at their request. Any member of Congress can sit at the negotiation table as an advisor. And there is a special advisory committee for both the House and the Senate to help the administration work out the strategy, etc. So in effect, what you have is a constant instruction, looking over the shoulder, just pulling people back, telling you can't do this, you can't do that, etc., giving feedback, and everything is public. Normally, when you negotiate, you try to you exchange texts, but you don't want to make them public. You don't, because some of something you might want to pull back or you might change, etc. And you don't want to have to explain later on why have you made this concession, what you get before, and etc. There's always somebody who loses something is not very happy about it. Here, the process is dictated. Congress says, you're doing it for us, you are our servant, and these are the rules, and that's what you have to do. So it's a completely different system. It also is basically reflects what Congress wants. There is no coherent background study or anything. Just today, Mr. Lighthizer said, they have never done an analysis of what is the impact of NAFTA withdrawal. You're negotiating an agreement. The president is threatening to withdraw. And you haven't even bothered to study what would be the impact of a withdrawal. I mean, that just gives you an idea how these negotiations are being conducted. Now, when you're a negotiator and you sit from them, you see this in action all the time. Given that the Congress is consulting, the U.S. negotiator, every time when you discuss something, runs through their mind, will this fly in front of Congress or not? That is the ultimate test, after all. If it flies, will it fly? Will there be enough? Or will this be so crucial to Senator X or Congressman Y, et cetera, that they will use their power to block it? And that is the litmus test for them, not the way we will look at it. What does it do for us in terms of trade? What is the benefit? It's obviously, we have political consideration too, but they are not up front. They are the sort of secondary nature. In the American system, it's exactly the other way around. And to give you an example, as you all know, the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement was negotiated in basically 48 hours at the end of it. Secretary Baker became the last-minute leader of the U.S. negotiation twice in those 48 hours. He broke off negotiations to go to the Hill to consult, not to go to the White House. No. He knew who calls the shots. It's the Congress. And he went to Congress to make sure, assume he informed the White House what he was doing, and maybe somebody from the White House along, but the fact that it was Congress that was important drives the point home. And USTR's role itself is not very strong. USTR is not a big player in the Washington power scene. It's not a department. He's not a secretary. He's called ambassador. And he basically has teams made up from other departments, and somebody from his office will head it. But let's say we're talking about agriculture, there's a subcommittee on agriculture to deal with agricultural issues. There will be several members from the Department of Agriculture on there, and maybe customs, etc. And they are very strong, and they actually speak. And there's quite often a sort of a discussion between them. And then it's not unusual for the USDR to put a point of view forward, but basically you see that their heart isn't in it, but they've been told, push this forward, et cetera, and they put it forward and waiting for us to shoot it down, saying, hey, this makes no sense, et cetera, et cetera, because they don't really control the delegation, and that makes it sometimes very awkward for you, because you find you're, in effect, a peacemaker between two different U.S. Government employees. The other thing is that the U.S., given the U.S. civil servant system, all the top people are political appointments. They're exceedingly bright, well-educated, very eloquent, etc. But they are really not masters of the files. The masters of the file, the people who really know it, are the public servants who work but who cannot aspire to the top level. As a result of that, they all have a bit of an inferiority complex. They know that they are second rate because with their first rate, they would have gone to the private sector or they would have been appointed politically. That's really how they feel. When you get to know them, I'm just a public servant. But it's they that know for this stuff. They really know. If you want to negotiate with them, you've got to bring them in. As a Canadian negotiator, it's your job to bring them in. They're usually very quiet. And he says, Steve, you know more, but you've done this for 20 years. Tell me about this, et cetera. And bring him in and bring him. And he can bring very valuable things, because you have to understand, as always, the devil's in the detail. If you don't master the details, perfect example, rules of origin. Nothing can be more complete, difficult, arcane. It's like the Income Tax Act. And frankly, we screwed it up in the Canada-US agreement, and we then fixed it in NAFTA. Well, I guarantee you, nobody at the table, from Carla, whether it's Friedland, Leichhardt, or any of the top people, has ever read Ultra Rules of Origin, knows how they work, or could make meaning of them. They deal with big concepts, yes. The U.S. concept has to go up from 45 to 50, or whatever the number is. But how do you do it? What do you actually do? How do you write this, etc.? And you will only be able to have an agreement which later on can be translated in translation in meaningful if you spell out at least the fundamental things that you're going to change. But for that, you need the knowledge of the people who actually live with this, etc. So it is a funny way, but you actually spend a lot of time trying to make sure that the second tier of the U.S. negotiators participates because they have the detailed inside knowledge. Thirdly, the Americans always look at everything through the U.S. prism. This is how we do it here in Canada, in the U.S. Why can't you do it like this in Canada? And you know, why do they do that? Not because they are against what we are doing. They know that whatever they agree that something is different than the American, they got to explain that to their congressman or to the senator. And they know how it's done in the U.S., and they don't want to learn how it's done in other countries. So something saying it's equivalent, has the same effect, etc., usually doesn't cut the ice. Because, hey, that may be true. It may work that way. But how am I going to sell that to Congress? That's in my mind as a U.S. negotiator. How do I sell it to Congress? Give you a perfect example. Canada-U.S. free trade agreement, one of the big issues was plywood. In those days, it was a big product. And in the U.S., the test was whether the knot holes were 2 inches, 3 inches, or 4 inches. It was grade A, B, C. In Canada, we had a test on when does the stuff delaminate under temperature, etc. Basically, it was the same test. It's just different measurement. There's absolutely no way we could resolve that. We made a little side agreement and got the industry together again. And at the end of the day, we basically caved and came up with a standard, which is a mutual standard, which is basically the American one with a few whistles added to it. But it was just perfect example, you know. That everybody understands the knot hole size. What are you talking about, delamination at 10 degrees or 15 degrees? That's a completely different thing. Why, I can't get that to sell that to Senator so-and-so. You know. And then they also think and very often feel that if there isn't something in there that they have in the U.S. and it's not respected there, it's unacceptable. I'll give you a perfect example. Chapter 19, which I was heavily involved in negotiating, has a provision that, of course, that is a decision by the in the agency, it can go to judicial review. They insisted that the agency who's being reviewed has standing in the review proceeding. And I said, why? They are a neutral body. All their ruling, there is a dumping or no dumping. Now their decision is being, why should they have it? They have no interest in the outcome. Why should they have the right to inform? Well, under U.S. law, they have that right. We can't take it away. Now we have to put it. So it is in Chapter 19. It's never been used. Certainly I don't know if any Canadian agency has ever used it. But again, this is... Please do me a favor, keep it in, otherwise I've got a problem in Congress, right? Now, one other feature of the U.S. is that everything winds up in court. No matter what policy you talk about, at some point in time it will wind up in court and will have to be decided by the court. And the U.S. negotiators know that. They also know that in the U.S. court you can bring in all sorts of external evidence in order to clarify something, show intention, and if there's any ambiguity, resolve it. So the negotiating records, the testimony of people for parliament, etc., all of that can be admitted later on if you have a dispute. They know that, so they're constantly trying to create a record to document their decisions. And you feel you get all sorts of papers and you get all sorts of why are we talking about that? Why are you well, you know, I just want to have it on the record so that it can be used later on. They also have something called a statement of administrative action. Once you have the agreement and you go to Congress, you say, Congress, here's the agreement, here's the legislation, and to tie the two together, to explain what this is, this statement of administration action that says, here's the obligation that we assumed, this is what we have to do by way of legislation, this has to do by regulation, et cetera, and this is because this is the overall intent. Wonderful, except in every agreement that you negotiate, you have something that's called constructive ambiguity. There's some area that you cannot agree on. So you find some amorphous language that you read one way and I read another way and we both go home. And every diplomat does it, every treaty has that. And if it ever comes to a problem, let some future court, et cetera. But here comes the statement of administrative action, and it actually puts forward the very thing you have just tried to hide in ambiguous language, you know, and comes up. So we in Canada have, as a result, adopted something called the statement of implementation, so we can put our interpretation also on the table, and then later on, as you have this amorphous language and you have two interpretations, and if it ever comes to dispute, it will be dealt with. Lastly, you know, for us, NAFTA is extremely important. It makes the headline, it dominates everything, etc. It's the issue of the day. But it's not in the US. They have an awful lot of other issues, you know, both in trade and otherwise, etc. And getting the attention of them is very difficult. If you read, I looked at today's issue of Inside US Trade, for instance. There are two mentions of NAFTA and there's three other mentions, you know. And this is the number one trade Bible, essentially, in the US. So unless there is a crisis or a deadline, it's very hard to get the whole town to focus on it, to come to a resolution and do something. Michael Wilson told me that when he negotiated the Canada-US agreement, the Secretary of State Baker actually told him, listen, we are crisis-driven. We haven't got a crisis. Until we have a crisis, this won't get resolved. Once we have it, we'll focus on it, we'll do it. We'll do it. As he said, we'll cut this baby in 54 hours. It took 48 hours, but he was absolutely right. Now, we don't have a crisis here. Trump is trying to create one. He threatens to tear it up. Tearing it up does not end NAFTA, because NAFTA is all embedded in legislation. And Trade negotiating authority expires next summer, but it can be extended by another 2 years. So there is no obvious crisis in that. So unless Trump does something, and who knows, we don't know, it's not going to come together. The whole town has to concentrate on this issue to actually get a resolution. So in summary, the U.S. process is very uncoordinated, very polycentric, but it's driven by Congress. The administration is only the mouthpiece, a large one, and right now a very unpredictable one, but it is there, and they have to call it, which is good and bad. It may, to the extent there are interests in the U.S. that favor NAFTA, they will have to persuade Congress, obviously. Trump will try to do the other way. But I can only say I don't envy the U.S. negotiators having to negotiate under the TPA authority, where Congress watches you at every step and can interfere. You have the echo of Trump on the side with his tweets. And for the Canadian negotiators, the key is you've got to understand what's the other side. You know what you want, but you've got to understand what is the environment the other side works on, what are the constraints for them. And once you understand that, you can play with it and can play some things off against it and hopefully get a good solution. Thank you.
Good evening. I apologize for the coughing. I've got NAFTA-itis, which is four NAFTA speeches in 3 days, and my throat is not keeping up with me. First of all, though, let me say how cool it is to be on a panel with Conrad von Finkenstein. I mean, he obviously knows a whole lot about the agreements. He obviously gets the complexity. But what some of you might not know, especially people who were born after 1989, is this fellow was really one of the architects of the agreement. For people born after 1989, you have always had free trade agreements in your life. You have always had Canada-U.S. free trade agreement. We've been negotiating one with, you know, Central America, Peru, European Union. This has become a fact of life. But the Canada-U.S. free trade agreement is the first modern trade agreement ever. I mean, there's been some light ones otherwise, but the sort of provisions that were negotiated during the 80s formed the foundations not just for the NAFTA, but also for the modern WTO agreement. So things like services, dispute settlement, intellectual property, that all was part of the conversations that the Canadians and Americans were having. And what's cool about CONRAD is everyone acknowledges that the negotiators would negotiate and they'd be hammering stuff out, basically inventing new provisions where none existed before, and then they'd run back to CONRAD and said, is this a real thing? Can we do this? Does this pass the legal smell test? So he was the legal review for this brand new agreement that nobody had seen before. And any negotiator from that period will tell you that Canadians owe a great debt to Mr. von Finkelstein. So it is wonderful to be on the same panel with him. When I was asked, thank you for the invitation, Annie, when I was invited to come to Toronto to do a debate about free trade, I'm like, oh no, those Torontonians. I love talking about trade, but you guys, the Toronto ones, people always throw fruit at me. Or maybe that's just U of T. Maybe it's a more polite crowd up here. And I would be really happy to talk about some of the areas where free trade agreements miss the mark and some of the areas that they could be improved for social elements and expand to greater good and things that are absent. But for tonight's purposes, we maybe don't have a crisis, but we're near to a crisis. So let's take it as stipulated that for us as Canadians, free trade agreements are a fact of life. And in particular, trade with the United States, love them or hate them, is the basis of our economy. 20% of Canadian GDP is dependent on trade with the United States. 70% of Canadian exports go to the United States. 80% of Ontario's exports, and 2 million jobs in Canada. So we can argue about the niceties and the elements that could be changed, improved, updated, but that core economic chunk is the driver of Canada, and I really think it's in jeopardy. So let's take it as written that it's a trade agreement worth defending for now. It is. I've been doing trade as a graduate student, and then as a consultant for a really, really long time. In fact, one of my early experiences as a young trade analyst was working for something called the Center for Trade Policy and Law in Ottawa, and my new boss, Bill Diamond, who some of these guys up front will know, Canada's former ambassador to Brazil and representative to the OECD, he was negotiating a deal that a lot of people didn't like. It had to do with investment. You can Google it, multilateral agreement on investment. And I remember being in the Unitarian Church in Ottawa with him and looking at a crowd like this, but it was an angry mob, and they were waving their fists and saying, if you sign this agreement, we're going to be selling our water to Americans. Americans are going to be taking over our hospitals. Americans are going to be running our schools. This is selling Canadian sovereignty out the door. And the minister of the Unitarian Church even kind of lunged at him, and the RCMP had to escort my boss out the door. So that was 1999. This is a different time. We have lived with trade agreements. We recognize that there are problems with them. They can be improved, but they are a fundamental fact of Canadian life. As a trading nation, we are a small country, a small population, and we need to engage with global markets in order to be as prosperous as we can. These are the strangest negotiations I have ever seen. When you approach a trade negotiation, each party gives at least lip service to the fact that they want to do a deal. In this negotiation, one party has said explicitly, I want to kill this deal. And Canada and Mexico have come to the table to defend the status quo, at least, and hopefully modernize and improve the agreement. But the United States, strong factions of it, have said, no trade agreement is a good agreement. We want to kill what we've got. Now, that's not a very nuanced position. So let me break it down. Canada and Mexico want to defend the status quo. They are not willing to accept a deal tomorrow that is worse than the deal that they have today. So, for example, the recent U.S. offer on government procurement is so bad, dials back the clock so far that Bahrain would have greater access to U.S. government contracts than Canada was. So that is definitely a marked, you know, disimprovement, whatever it means. When you go backwards, that's what the U.S. is offering. So Canada and Mexico have said, hold the line. We're not accepting anything worse tomorrow than we have today. And if possible, let's make this a better deal, because there's all sorts of reasons to do it. And this, you know, NAFTA is a senior citizen, negotiated before there was digital economy, before there was cross-border movement of services, before there was third-party logistics, before there was all sorts of things that are the basis of our modern economy. So we could very well make it better. We also have this agreement, well, Canada and Mexico do now, called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, in which all three countries negotiated some pretty good stuff. Again, out in the hallway, you can beat me up about the TPP, but for now, some of the good stuff is the digital modernization chapter, which really helps with Canada's service economy and e-commerce and moving things across borders effectively and efficiently and building Canada's IT and high-tech industries. So we could actually modernize the NAFTA with some of these TPP positions. The U.S., is dominated. So Canada and Mexico have a fairly unified national position. The U.S. Has three distinct factions that are each struggling for control of the agenda in these negotiations. It's actually not hard to see who's leading, who's in the lead in this struggle for control. But it does change somewhat, and it probably will change, as my friend the negotiating specialist will say. I hope it changes over the life of these negotiations. So the U.S. three factions are what I call the sort of Republican internationalists, led by this guy named Gary Cohn, who you never hear about in the White House. And it's basically a pro-business, open markets, globalization, we're not afraid to compete out there in the world position that we kind of expect the Americans to have in the world. They're not getting a lot of traction right now, but their greatest level of support is probably within Congress, within the Republican members of Congress. But frankly, Congress is busy with other things right now. NAFTA is number 98 on their priority list right now. So there will be some support for this Republican international position in Congress, but right now it's very, very latent. The second faction is what I call the weaponized mercantilists. The current USTR, Robert Lighthizer, comes from a bygone era of in trade rules, might makes right. And he's an expert in steel and dumping and anti-dumping and the sort of legal instruments that you can use to tie your trading partners up in knots. And frankly, he wants a lot more of these legal instruments. And he'd really like to use the instruments that are available to him, not to promote global trade, not to promote U.S. Expansion in the world, but to bring it back, to tie it back. They don't want Americans investing or producing elsewhere in the world. What they really want is to keep American money in America. And so there are investment rules that would protect the ability of investors to settle disputes if there's a problem in a foreign country. USTR would like to take that right away from Americans and Canadians and Mexicans because they don't want that money going offshore. So it's this kind of inward-looking, mercantilist, high barriers, nationalized economies, which is a very old idea. It's a 1937 idea, Smoot-Hawley tariff kind of idea that we see coming out of these weaponized mercantilists. And what I mean weaponized is these bringing back these old legal instruments and just putting them on supercharge so you can really, really beat up on your trading partners with them. And then the third faction is the Trump populists. And this is the group for whom no agreement is a good agreement. This is a group of well-meaning, mostly Americans, who have bought the discourse that trade is bad. And you don't have to go to Terre Haute, Indiana to meet these folks. My cousins in Northern Ontario, your cousins in Saskatoon, our cousins in, I don't know, Mississauga. the idea that there are foreigners who are coming away in and taking away our traditional rights to something is a very persuasive argument. It's a very persuasive message. It's not true, but it is a persuasive message, and if you're someone who feels displaced, who was working in a low-wage assembly job and doesn't have that job anymore, you're looking for someone to blame. And so that is the constituency that most that Donald Trump's message most resonates with, and he wants to keep those folks on side because he's my president, and they show up at those rallies. So for that faction, NAFTA negotiations are not about a trade agreement. It's about positioning Donald Trump for the next election. And so these three groups sort of wiggle back and forth, and once in a while Donald Trump will get a phone call from Justin. He doesn't, No, he knows Trudeau's first name, and he doesn't know the Mexican president's name at all, or he can't say Peña Nieto. So when he refers to his NAFTA counterparts, it's always, Justin and the Mexican president have talked me into keeping staying at the negotiations again. So those are the three factions. Again, we have three types of issues. We have the modernization issues, which are the things that are sort of coming in from Trans-Pacific Partnership and have to do with digital economy, et cetera. And those are relatively non. I feel like I should be getting out of bed. Those are relatively non-controversial issues. And they're actually making some headway. There's 28 negotiating tables, and actually 23 of them are progressing pretty fine, actually. They're getting towards some settlement, or at least have the basis for settlement on 23 of these things. But we only hear about the five really, really bad things. So we have the modernization issues that people agree on. And then we have the greatest hits. That's the things that Canada and the U.S. always disagree about, that Mr. von Finkenstein, you know, was part of those early negotiations, you know, softwood lumber, supply management, the U.S. Jones Act, et cetera. These are our persistent irritants that we're always going to argue about, and hopefully over time we will progressively reduce the levels of protection. So those are the greatest hits issues, and then we've got what I call the poison pills. I was with Minister Freeland this week. She calls them very nicely the unconventional issues. Basically, USTR making stuff up. Trade rules and approaches and conventions we've never heard of before, and we have no idea how you would operationalize, like make the agreement disappear, like Snapchat, if the trade deficit goes up. And I don't know if that whose deficit that is, if it's the Mexican deficit. We don't have they don't have a deficit with Canada, but it's, you know, the disappearing Snapchat agreement. Rules of origin is another one of those. There's no North American manufacturer that can meet the rules of origin as they've been presented by USTR this week. Nobody can do it. So it may be good for keeping automotive jobs in North America, but all the factories are going to be gone, and that kind of sucks. What else? Government procurement rule. Government procurement, we already mentioned. Bahrain's going to have a better deal. Your premier has said, though, that she will retaliate, and she will put a Buy Ontario measure in if Ontario service providers are being blocked from U.S. contracts. So watch the space for more details. And the Sunset Clause, disappearing trade agreement. These are things that are non-conventional and are coming directly from the administration. I mean, Conrad was talking about how you always have to be talking to Congress, and it's all about approval by Congress. And for the most part, it is. But for these killer issues, it's an audience of one. It's Donald Trump, and what does he think is going to play to his core constituency? So what I see happening is they're going to be negotiating around these killer issues, these immovable objects, and they'll be working on those 24 tables, trying to bring them to some sort of provisional settlement, and then we will be left with a situation where the outcomes are the negotiations will be suspended because we can't go any farther, and we'll hope for better times. That's a possibility, because if that happens, we just revert to the status quo of a NAFTA that's kind of old, but not too bad, and that wouldn't be the worst thing. Or negotiations are suspended and Donald Trump launches a withdrawal mechanism. And I think that's highly possible. But again, as Canadians, we tend to think of the policy process as unrolling in a fairly incremental momentum. This happens, this happens, this happens, this happens, royal assent, Bob's your uncle. in the United States, this is just the beginning. The negotiations are just the beginning of the conversation. There's all sorts of opportunities for judicial actions and injunctions in courts and to-ing and fro-ing with Congress. So while the negotiators may reach an impasse, there's lots that could be done with the U.S. courts and U.S. Congress. And not telling any tales, but Canadians are down in Washington talking to large U.S. business organizations, you can figure out who they are, about legal opportunities to slow down or stop the potential actions against the NAFTA. If you really want to know whether they can dig it out of the ground or not, talk to John Johnson in the front row, brilliant trade lawyer from the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade. He was also present at the creation of these agreements. He knows a lot more about it than I do. But we are in a very difficult place right now. Canadians are putting on a brave face. The negotiators are doing very well. Canadian negotiators are doing very well. Canada and Mexico have agreed to stick together on these issues. They are quite closely aligned. But it is the toughest and most bizarre trade negotiation I have ever seen, and I'm pretty old. So we will have some very interesting things to write and talk about and think about. But what concerns me most is that 20% of Canadian GDP that could fall by the wayside. Canada has been very good at diversifying. The EU agreement is great. TPP is great. Even talking to China is, I think, something that should happen. But you cannot replace the size of that market anytime soon. And even if we don't lose the whole market because of retaliatory tariffs, even if Conrad's agreement, the Canada-US Free Trade Agreement, comes back into force, the destabilizing effect on North America as a whole, I think, is going to be huge. The risk of investing in North America when you don't know if your investment is going to be protected, if you don't know if you can move a product across the border, if you don't know if your worker is going to be arrested at the airport, that is a real chilling effect on commerce and investment. And I think that will spin off to Canada in a significant and serious way. Sorry to be such a downer, but very nice to see you. Thank you.
Like my co-panelists, I also want to thank Annie for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. You've heard from subject matter experts tonight, so I'm going to leave the subject matter to them and try to shift focus a bit by talking a bit about these negotiations from a more general negotiation perspective. And in the course of doing that, what I'd like to do is introduce five or six concepts that you can use to make sense of what you see in the newspapers when you read about what's going on. And we can certainly talk about what Canada should do about it. That's sort of the second half. I think I'm going to keep my remarks just to the lenses because we were asked to speak fairly briefly so we could get the audience involved in interaction. So I've got some ideas about short-term and long-term actions that Canada should take, but let's set those to the side. So just to pull back for a second, in terms of the undertaking, the original NAFTA document covers trade and goods, technical barriers to trade, government procurement, investment, services, intellectual property. There are 8 parts, 22 chapters, over 2,200 articles. It's a massive document, right? So revising it, modernizing it on the face of it is a massive and complex undertaking. So far, in the renegotiations, what we've heard is that there are 25 or 24 categories of topics. As Laura mentioned, the negotiations have been structured so there are tables on each of these topics. There are concurrent negotiations going on in each of these topics. Since August, there have been 4 rounds, 3 to 5 days each, and now there's a break. Clearly, one of the big concerns in public discourse here in Canada has been bargaining power or the asymmetry of power, right? How do you negotiate against such a monster? So that's what I'd like to start with, this idea of bargaining power. What are we talking about? We're talking about the ability to reach a result on one's own terms, right? And we look at the US and we see 10 times the size when it comes to GDP, 10 times the population. So much power. How do you negotiate against that big a counterpart? Typically, from a negotiation perspective, when you're trying to understand power relationships, you look at alternatives. And the concept that's been talked about for many years now is the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. If Canada can't reach an agreement with the US, what alternatives do they have? And what's their best alternative? And obviously, there's concern that Canada doesn't have a good alternative. So that makes them even weaker. My concern with this framing is that it's in power terms. And it's as if we should try to fight fire with fire. Maybe another way to look at it is to think about, well, what power is really about is influencing the counterpart. What other resources and capabilities does Canada have in a different currency, right? Something other than size of the economy or size of the population that might influence the US? So that's the first thing that I'd encourage you to think about, right? What does power actually mean, and where does it come from, and what power resources might Canada be able to count on in this particular exercise? And when it comes to a couple of other concepts, let's divide them into those specific to the counterpart and those having to do with a US-Canada relationship. With respect to the counterpart, positions, bargaining positions versus interests, right? We hear Lighthizer and others talk about what they say they want, but what is it that they really want? They say they want at least 50% US content on automobiles. Is that what they want? Is that really what they want? What is the underlying interest that's motivating? Is they want jobs, more jobs in the auto sector? Can you fish out from behind what they're saying what they're really interested in and then target those concerns or interests? That's what really needs to be focused on from the Canadian perspective. And this ties in with what Conrad was talking about when it comes to understanding the counterpart and the environment they're working in. That's part of it, but the other part of it is, what do they really want? What are they driving at, as distinct from what they say they want? Also, when it comes to this, good faith. I mean, we talk about, you know, do those who are negotiating really have a sincere interest in reaching an agreement? Are they negotiating in good faith? Is that the case here or not? Or are they negotiating for side effects? Is there some other interest that they're pursuing via this negotiation route? Communication challenges. Negotiation is a verbal process. Words are the currency of exchange. Right? I offer you this, I reject that, I accept that, I threaten this. At a minimum, you need to be able to sort out the message from the noise. What a challenging exercise in this particular set of negotiations. Right? And you've got a Trump, a head of government who has a very unconventional communication style, to say the least. Added to that, you've got principal and agent challenges, right? And Conrad was talking about Congress being sort of the principal here, but I think you could also say that Trump is the one that is really pushing this, and USTR is negotiating on his behalf. Who should Canada pay attention to? USTR, the agent, or Trump? And what if the messages are inconsistent? Whose do you go after? And the trouble with Trump's messages so often, I think, is that even within Trump, the messages are inconsistent. So which ones do you choose to follow? There's also a dual audience problem. And this has to do with messages that are maybe directed at one counterpart, but they're really intended for someone else. So when American negotiators are taking fairly extreme positions, for example, are they really communicating a message that's intended for their Canadian counterparts, or are they talking to be heard by their constituents back home, right? And how can Canada go about trying to disambiguate between the intended audiences? And I think the challenge here is that in Canada, we have access to so much of the internal discussion in the US that we need to be careful about sort of what sense or interpretation we give to the messages we hear. Will they be different for us? And where's the consistency between the messages that are delivered internally and those that are delivered to Canadian counterparts or negotiators? There's also a two-level negotiation problem. Right? You've got the external negotiations, the negotiations going on between the Canadian and Mexican and US representatives, but you've also got negotiations going on internally within the US. To what extent do those internal negotiations influence, negatively or positively, the negotiations that are going on horizontally at the external level? And what do negotiators who are involved in the external negotiators do in order to take into account what's going on internally? Linkages. This is a very multidimensional relationship between the US and Canada. Issues in one sector influence or affect issues in others. And these repercussions, these consequences, are not always simple or easy to measure. We were just talking about local content, for example. How do you go about figuring out the consequences of the issues that you're dealing with and the proposals or answers that you come up with to try to solve them? And I guess the last point that I would make is, and it's interesting to me that so much of the discussion and public coverage is about the U.S. and Canada, but this is a three-party negotiation, right? Mexico is involved. There are different ways that you can set up three-party negotiations. You can have combinations of bilaterals. You can have tripartite negotiations where all three parties at the table at the same time. You can have coalitions, right? Laura was talking about Canada and Mexico so far being aligned against the U.S. I guess one of the parting or last thoughts I would have on this is, what role can Canada play vis-a-vis Mexico or this U.S.-Mexico relationship? Is there a mediating or facilitating role that can play in this three-party negotiation as opposed to just looking at it as a head-to-head U.S.-Canada two-party negotiation? The other thing that's possible in a three-party negotiation is circular bargains. All right, Party A can give something to Party B, Party B can give something to Party C, and C might be able to give something to A. Whereas if A and B were just negotiating, a deal wouldn't be struck. So these are just a few concepts I'd like to sort of put on the table for us to use as lenses as we look at the negotiations between the three parties, the renegotiations of the NAFTA agreement, and hopefully we can kick it into the debate or Q&A section from here.
Thanks very much, everybody. Everybody's taller than me, as usual. I don't know, are there questions? Have people got questions? Excellent.
Trade agreement the world has ever seen, and the way you came to the point, what we're discussing.
Excuse me, sir. The translators have asked that you move to the microphone so they can hear what you're saying.
I'll reiterate his question into the mic. Perfect. And then the next questioner will use that. Okay. This gentleman very rightly asks about the Canada-EU Free Trade Agreement and what the heck is up with that and how that might play into the NAFTA negotiations. And you're absolutely right. We each had 8 minutes to speak, and I took 18, so I had to edit a little bit. First of all, it provides Canada with an advantage because it is a set of new market access opportunities that Canada has in the European Union and vice versa. So it cements and expands the Canada-EU relationship and reduces Canada's dependency on the United States. Secondly, it's provided us with some framework, some new mechanisms for solving problems that didn't exist before. Conrad may take me to task on this because I may have it completely wrong, but there were some things negotiated on investor-state dispute settlement that are more nuanced, that provide extra levels of transparency and permanent boards and other stuff that could be used as a bit of a middle ground position, could be entered into the NAFTA. So I think it's a demonstrator, it's a model of some of the things that could be brought into the NAFTA if this was a real negotiation. It provides Canada with some comfort in the diversification aspect. But on the other hand, there are two trade agreements or trade blocks tend to follow sort of like genealogies, Hatfields and McCoys families. And so the American family that Canada has followed through the NAFTA, the TPP, is based on U.S. commercial policy priorities. CETA brings in more EU commercial policy priorities, issues to do with the Federation, precautionary principle, more broad consultative stuff. So some of that is a bit of a system friction between the European way of doing things and the North American way of doing things. One of these smart guys might have something else to say.
No, I agree with everything you said. I just
That's the a other good starting point, Conrad.
Always good.
But too bad it's the debate.
But it's the dynamics are totally different. I told you the U.S. trade the control is in Congress. We don't know whether Congress wants an agreement or not. We really don't. It's everything we've seen. When Laura went through the points that are traditional, et cetera, it's essentially an improvement of the existing provisions of NAFTA. There has been no indication that they want to go into a more elaborate, detailed, modern agreement a la CETA. Certainly the investor state is anything but, I would think, which is really a binational court between us and the EU. It would be dead on arrival in the U.S., I would think. And the whole motivation is different in CETA. CETA, both sides wanted, both sides saw it, also the way it was negotiated. You didn't see the text until it was finalized. It's not like we do with here, where every single negotiation session is essentially public, and everything that's being said afterwards is magnified by the president on top of it. So I don't think they're really very much parallels. We've learned a lot from CETA, but they can be applied to NAFTA negotiations. I don't see that necessarily falling.
Thanks very much. I think the gentleman in the bush shirt, the county tuxedo. No?
Okay. Bonsoir, merci beaucoup. Bienvenue à Glendon. Mon nom est Yann Robert. Je suis le vice-principal aux affaires académiques. We know that the Canadian government has asked for something that would resemble a clause on gender rights and a clause on indigenous rights out of these negotiations, and we often see in news reports various references to it. I'm curious as to what those clauses would actually contain and what they would actually look like. I'm also curious, and I hate to be sort of old conservative-minded, but I'm not quite sure I also understand the logic and the rationale in having such clauses in a trade agreement. And third, assuming that an agreement would actually come out of it, what is the likelihood that we would see either of these clauses in the final deal?
Merci. Can I start, Conrad?
Oh, please.
I will be the Pollyanna, and you can be the skunk at the garden party. So One of the great things about trade agreements that has makes them different from all other kinds of agreements is they actually have a binding, they have an enforcement mechanism that is economic. You can actually use a trade agreement to impose economic penalties for noncompliance. Not that it's very easy, not that it's done very often, but theoretically that works. And so all sorts of other issues have migrated to trade agreements and said, hey, let's bring environment over there, let's bring labor over there, let's bring all sorts of other things so we can use that dispute settlement and enforcement mechanism for our benefit. Now, when I was young and cynical, I used to think that's a terrible idea. Use trade agreements for trade, use environmental agreements for environment, and, you know, never the twain shall meet. I have become enlightened in my old age, and I see that while the progress on these side issues is slower and different, it does have a disciplining effect, a focusing effect. It gets people to pay attention to it. So in the original NAFTA, we had an environment and a labor side agreement that was pretty meh. Basically said, you'll have some rules, I'll have some rules, hopefully the rules will get enforced. But as it has developed through other agreements, because these things go through like genealogical changes in other agreements, they've gotten a little bit tighter. And in the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, has got a version of that that says, you know, we're going to take the disputes, and we're actually going to use binding dispute settlement within the agreement. It's not just going to be I'm okay, you're okay. So there's been some evolution there. And again, it also makes people focus on these issues. What are we actually going to get in a gender and an indigenous rights, et cetera, additions? Precious little at this point. On the other hand, the U.S. is probably not going to push back against it because there's nothing to push back against. Mexico is kind of for it because it's big on indigenous rights and women and other things too. So it's going to likely be some inclusion in the text of best efforts to promote the rights of women entrepreneurs, of indigenous business people, and at least we're going to be taking a look at them. We're going to be saying, is this important? If this is important, how do we act on it? The only model we have right now for this other stuff is the Canada-Chile agreement's got a gender chapter. Go read it. It's pretty light and pretty loose. But if an issue is important enough, it should take some wings of its own. It should get some more robust disciplines. And who knows, maybe it'll actually have some hard obligations in your children's generation. Is that okay?
Well, like you, like the questioner, I don't see the connection between gender or indigenous rights or so and trade. If there is one, and Laura is absolutely right, it's a good mechanism to enforce it, etc. And the only one I can even think of is indigenous art and the restoration of the indigenous art to indigenous people, etc. There is actually a firm obligation that you could somehow build around and say we respect that, we do it, and we mutually enforce it, etc., etc. Gender, I'm sorry, I'm at a loss to see what the obligation is. And so the ones, if the agreements that have a clause on gender is essentially motherhood, basically saying we believe in equal rights for genders and will promote policies to that effect. You know, is it a beginning of something more? It seems to me you have to have an obligation or to make this meaningful. I don't quite understand how you link that obligation to trade, but maybe right now I think they were just thrown in there, A, for domestic political reason, and B, just to counter some of the craziness that comes from down south. It's something that makes sense. You know, at least it's a good cause. You know, it's not something that doesn't make any sense at all.
And trade agreements are really good at prohibitions. They're really good at saying, thou shalt not trade in endangered species. Thou shalt be respectful of indigenous art. They're very poor at creating positive behaviors and supporting this kind of business and supporting that kind of business. And I think that's what Stalin tried to do, and it didn't really work well for him either.
Steven, two quick points. The beauty of combining economic issues with others is that it might facilitate trade-offs if you're stuck on issues within one section, right? And with respect to indigenous issues, there are economic connections. I mean, having just spent the last month studying Hydro-Quebec and the Cree dispute in James Bay, and then looking at how heavily tied Hydro-Quebec's exports are to New England states, U.S. states, There is a connection there between indigenous issues and economic consequences and trade, for that matter.
Indeed. So I think this gentleman is now number one.
Hi. my question centered mostly around, like you were talking about, how a trilateral trade agreement can be difficult, and also on the role of Mexico. So there was some talk floated around that a bilateral talk would be easier and preferred by the U.S. and such. And then there was subsequent talk on Canadian news, at least, saying that that might not be a good idea for Canada and that we'd lose some bargaining power. But when it comes to Mexico, if Mexico was offered a bilateral status quo agreement, would they take it and run and leave us with a second? Because one of the things that I think it was Newt Gingrich was on the National, he said there's not going to be a deal until the presidential election in Mexico. I was just kind of wondering how influential they will be and how this turns out.
On the trade side, do you know?
Yeah, it would be really hard. I mean, we talk about a Canada-U.S. bilateral deal because there happens to be a default agreement sitting around from 1989 that we could potentially use. But it would be really hard to offer a fresh bilateral deal to one side and not the other, because the text and the obligations and the everything is so embedded on a trilateral basis. You just can't you can't take the scrambled eggs apart and separate it into yolks and whites. So it would be very difficult. Also, I've never been a fan of the throw Mexico under the bus argument. Our economies are just too embedded. We don't have a lot of direct Canada-Mexico trade, but we have a huge amount of trade that goes through that big, bright, shiny object in the middle. And for companies like Linamar and Magna in the auto parts sector, for Scotiabank, for Canada Bread, for Bombardier, having Mexico is a really, really important trading partner. Canada and Mexico have already agreed. They're sticking to this agreement. They're not walking away from it. Mexico needs this agreement because of the investment measures, because they've just opened their energy sector to foreign investment. And if they don't have that investment protection available, those energy companies are going to flee. So Canada and Mexico have very strong interests in united front. They have differences in priorities on issues. Mexico does not care a whit about Canadian supply management, but they're staying fairly close together. It's a very united front, at least in terms of resisting those poison pill issues.
Yeah, I would just say two things. First of all, they will stick together as long as they have see it to their advantage. I mean, Mexico may change its tune. The leading candidate in the presidential election, Obrador, is totally against the NAFTA and wants to tear it up. So the Mexican position may change. Right now they're together. And the second point is, even if NAFTA has ended, I keep saying NAFTA is not a presidential agreement. He signed it, he can tear it up. But the effect will be zero. The effect will mean that we no longer have the Three Amigos meeting. The actual agreement works by virtue of the embedded legislation that embedded it. I'm personally spent hours, days going through the U.S. implementation, making sure they lived up to the agreement. We're talking something like 10,000 pages of legislation, setting all of this down. You have to change that in order to make it bilateral. And you can't just go back to the Canada-U.S. because lots of things have changed. And by the way, there were certain, as I mentioned before, the rules of origin under the Canada-U.S. agreement were horrible, and you certainly don't want to go back to them. That's all it. Purely speaking, legally, technically, the interests, of course, of economic interests, as Laura points out, inside the U.S. would also not favor that. So I don't know what Trump is talking about.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a strange and unusual place if we actually run this over. Now, for people in the audience that would like to speak, we have to have you go to a mic. And I will choose people by their position vis-a-vis the mic.
Sorry, John. You're going to have to go up the stairs.
Stephen, did you want to comment on that point?
Oh, good.
Okay. Sir.
Yeah, my question goes back to something that Dr. Weiss had mentioned earlier on about the positions, the actual motives of the parties involved. I'd like to put a hypothesis to the panel and get the response to it. What if on the U.S. side it has nothing to do with trade? Nothing to do with economics. It's all about politics. Mm-hmm. And it's driven by the administration's attempt to reshape and fracture U.S. politics. The president is still quite popular within his party. He has the new mercantilists with him, as pointed out. He has his own sort of nativist base with him. We're going into congressional elections next year in the United States. The primaries for those are going to happen over the beginning few months of 2018, about the time when the extended negotiations are due to come to an end. We have Steve Bannon out there recruiting people specifically to knock off people in the Senate and in Congress that might be in the internationalist camp on the Republican side, maybe get some angry Democrats switching over. What if this is an exercise in fracturing and restructuring American politics in the nativist Trumpian image? And once he has Congress behind him and they're all true believers, Mr. Von Finkelstein has pointed out, they can make the rules up as they go, or make up the rules up subsequently.
Nightmare scenario.
I fully agree with the first part of your hypothesis. And the first part of your hypothesis is what if this is all about politics? At least for the Trump populace and the weaponized mercantilists, it is all about politics. And the economic implications do not bear are not having any influence whatsoever. Where you and I depart is that I don't think that that argument can win over Congress. I think Congress is paying attention to other things right now, but a Republican-dominated Congress cannot afford to ignore the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, 31 governors, untold, especially in the U.S. Southwest. They're actually more powerful. The Mexican influence is more powerful pro-NAFTA in the U.S. Southwest than anything Canada is doing. For example, more than 50% of U.S. corn is exported to Mexico. If NAFTA disappears, they immediately get a 150% tariff on U.S. corn. That is having an impact. So Congress is not paying enough attention now. That's my concern. But I'm hoping sooner or later that Congress is mobilized to respond to the economic argument, which is a net loss of 250,000 U.S. jobs on Donald Trump's proposal.
Yeah, I think you're right in your analysis. It may very well be all political. But even if he gets, quote, a Congress elected, even his courts will have, have to deal with local interests. All politics is local. And if you're a senator from Iowa to vote for the discontinuation of NAFTA and negating the corn exports that you allow, that's political suicide. So I just don't see it happening.
Arkansas has two senators. Arkansas is the global capital of Walmart. You raise tariffs on U.S. consumer goods by 30%, you're going to lose Arkansas.
Excellent point. I think this young woman, then you, sir, and then up there.
Hi there. I was kind of hoping that this would be mentioned within the debate. How, because there is currently NAFTA negotiations, it opens chances for maybe some sort of discussion to find a solution on how to protect workers within the countries of that are within the NAFTA trade agreement. Mexican workers especially have been deeply exploited after this agreement has been made, and American workers have also not been protected under the NAFTA agreement, clearly, and a lot of industries have been affected and workers have lost many jobs. I was just wondering, has there been any discussion to begin proposing ideas within the NAFTA agreement that would protect workers in all three countries?
The labor conversation is really difficult, and I'm going to ask you to sort of unpack two things. One is about protecting workers' rights, fundamental conditions of work and pay, etc. And the other one is about keeping jobs, because those really are two different arguments. And when you make it more expensive to employ someone, you have to have fewer jobs. So let's talk about workers' rights for a moment. in the NAFTA, there is a labor discussion. There will be a labor side agreement. But the big sticking point there, and I know this sounds bizarre, Canada and Mexico have both signed the major ILO conventions on labor rights. They're signing and signed. And those are important to enshrining conditions, basic conditions of work. But one of those rights is the right to collective bargaining. And so Mexico and Canada are like, yeah, you should have unions. That should be okay. The U.S. can't sign that because they have U.S. right to work states, which do not have that, do not have the right to collective bargaining. So they're really at an impasse, and I just find it so bizarre that Mexico is promoting stronger labor rights than the U.S. is. But this is all text that's written down by negotiators. How does this trickle down to the actual factory floor in Mexico? And I get your point. There's a lot of difference between what we write down and what the conditions actually are. And so I would hope, when I was talking about, you know, we get better through trade agreements when we continue to pay attention to that, I would like to see us pay better attention to implementation and oversight and supervision and reporting to make sure that the things we say are important at the negotiating table are operationalized in all the countries that are signatories. It's not a great answer.
Labor is one of the subjects on the table. It's part of the U.S. Negotiating agenda. There's a whole page on what they want to. It starts off by saying put labor in the agreement. If you do that, the whole enforcement mechanisms of the agreement apply, not just to the way they're set out in the labor side agreement right now. So this would actually lead to a strengthening of the labor provisions here. Now, what will they actually will negotiate, I don't know. But when you look at the U.S. negotiating aims as set out by USDR, they clearly want to make labor an integral part of NAFTA, which can only strengthen the application of labor laws in Mexico, and which I remember from when we negotiated NAFTA, the Mexican laws on paper are actually pretty good, problem is they're not being enforced.
What are the labor provisions that are being stated within the NAFTA negotiations?
If you look in the original NAFTA agreement, there's a labor side agreement that will set out what's in there. And then if you go online to the USTR website, United States Trade Representative website, you can find their negotiating mandate that sets out in a great deal of detail what the U.S. wants. Canada doesn't publish its negotiating mandate, but the U.S. negotiating mandate is there. And that's a really good starting point for getting your head around the stuff.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Just following up on that one, Laura, I mean, it's true you can talk about labor provisions in the agreements, but the underlying issue here is the people voting for Donald Trump and the people voting for Marie Le Pen and the people voting for Brexit don't believe in free trade agreements. And somehow our governments have to begin to convince these people that, as you do, as you believe, that free trade agreements actually work on their behalf. And I don't think actually governments have done a particularly good job. And we had a little bit of a rough time with CETA, and we might have a rough time with other free trade agreements. But my real question actually goes back to your point that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce obviously supports a modernized agreement. Congress supports, some in Congress support a modernized agreement. So how does this play out? Lighthizer continues to put forward Trump's demands. We say no, what happens?
Yeah, that's a great question. It is not important enough to Congress yet. Also, they've been hampered by a really punishing text review process. This is the first round. They've just finished four rounds, and this is the first time they've been able to get U.S. proposals on almost all of the sections. Not all of them, but almost all the sections, because the new Trade Promotion Authority requirements are such that you have to get interagency sign-off on every measure that affects other government departments, and you have to get the U.S. proposal has to be vetted by the major trade committees, representatives of the major trade committees in the United States as well. So it's taking a really, really long time. So we've only now, just now, got text on the table. Again, as I said, I think they're going to take these dirty four and do what they can on the poison pill issues, and you know, sort of leave them there and try to get provisional settlement on everything else. And then the ball is in the U.S. court to either get Congress to stand up on its hind legs and reject these deal-killing elements, or to force Donald Trump to launch withdrawal proceedings. There's no good outcomes right now.
Hang on. There are all sorts of other little devices you can do. You can separate those people. You can modernize NAFTA and put it... all the improvements looking at CETA, et cetera, and you say these four issues, you can say these are no new issue, and you set up negotiating groups or saying you start a separate trade negotiation on those, et cetera. You don't just, so you can claim partial victory and say this is too tough to do with a limited time frame, but we even don't even answer. I mean, it's the politics that will drive this, not the economics or the trade. I mean, if they feel these four poison pill have to be dealt with, the question is how do you find a graceful exit, rather than that, you know, he gave up. No, they are still alive. He can claim credit for having raised them, but they have not yet been resolved. That would be sort of the best output, you know, whether they want to do it or not. But it's not an all or nothing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the punting it down the road for as long as possible and stretching it and contorting it is a very likely scenario, mm-hmm. and it would be better than the other things.
Thank you. But no, Stephen, do you want?
I was just going to say the other thing that might happen there is that the politics in Washington might settle down. I'm not at all convinced that
beautiful dreamer.
It's as unified right now as it appears to be, even with the Republicans controlling both the Senate and the House of Representatives. I mean, I think the country is in turmoil. Yes, Trump has his supporters, but he has a lot of opponents as well. And I think the domestic political scene is still up and is tumultuous. And it's tough to negotiate against the counterpart that isn't unified.
Or isn't negotiating from the point of view that they actually want an agreement either. That's pretty tough, sir.
Stephen, you mentioned the importance of figuring out what the other side really wants by a proposal that they put forward. One of the real complications here, as Conrad and Laura pointed out, is that one of the important bodies here is Congress. There are 100 senators, there's 400 some odd representatives, and they're all over the map. So from the standpoint of that particular aspect of negotiation, how in God's name do you figure that out?
I think Conrad's better equipped to answer that one than I am. Well, as he pointed out, the USTR published its objective, 17 pages worth. Someone at some point said there are over 100 objectives in it. That's a starting point. Do they shift over time? How do you flesh out the shifts? What really matters? What doesn't? I think that's a tough question. What can I say?
I can't answer the question, but
I don't think anybody really can.
No, but it's one observation which really boggles my mind is. Traditionally, the Republicans have been the party of trade, and the Democrats have been the party opposing trade. It got a little shook up under the Obama administration when they launched the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and all these Democrats said, gosh, we have to like trade agreements? All right. Now, they've gone back to their comfy place of not liking trade agreements, and so the position of the moderate Democrats that we as Canadians kind of feel like-minded with, these are the nice ones, they line up very nicely with the extreme right Trump populace. And well, that's a Baptist bootlegger coalition.
Yeah, but John, as you know, what you do is you test all of these very vague and broad promises in trying to find what is really behind it. What is some of them actually are not that hidden. I looked at them, for example, on the plane down. One says here, specialized sectoral disciplines. including rules to help the level of the playing field for U.S. delivery services suppliers in the NAFTA country. Well, it's obviously it's UPS and FedEx are behind it, so mm-hmm. that means which senators, so you know those sources. That's what the U.S. negotiators do all the time. I mean, some of these are encoded, so you take some negotiating and figure out for them. Others are pretty clear what is in mind, and then you try to find out a sufficient number so that you get the leadership of the Congress to back it. So some people will not get their points across, but that's the very onerous process you go through in the negotiation with the U.S. to see what is actually doing. I know you speak for Congress, but you don't spell it out, so I have through the dialogue, it comes to the fore what is actually the driving force between these points.
One of the curious things here is the auto proposals that the negotiators, the U.S. negotiators have put forward. The U.S. auto industry hates them. Mm-hmm. And historically with trade agreements, and certainly with the Canada-U.S. agreement and NAFTA, is that the USTR and the auto industry work very closely together to achieve the result they wanted. They're totally going in opposite directions now.
Yeah. Yeah. As I said, there is no automaker in North America that can make the requirements of USTR. And interestingly, the number one demand of Ford of the United States, had nothing to do with auto manufacturing. It was on currency controls. Canada and Mexico are not currency manipulators, but Ford wanted to get that into the NAFTA so that it would be a bedrock, a template for future negotiations. They wanted to bring the TPP language on currency manipulation.
You never know. Canadian dollar is like a yo-yo. Maybe somebody's manipulating it. I think it's this young man first.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
I'm often believe that trade agreements are more of a geopolitical nature than an economic one. For example, the TPP, I see it as more America trying to wrestle control over the South China Sea and the East Asian financial time zone than just purely for economic benefits between the two countries. So I also thought of a new slogan for our country, Canada. Instead of from sea to sea, I think it should be from sea to sea to sea, mm-hmm. because right now the Arctic is opening. In 2013, the vessel Nordic Orion has made successful voyage over the Northwest Passage. How does such geopolitical features affect these negotiations, such as NAFTA?
So I'll start. Geopolitics are the way that you get people's attention to trade agreements because they're really, honestly boring. What did Conrad say? 10,000 pages of implementation. They're about lentils and corn brooms. They're about things that you don't even want to think about in the agricultural sector. They're dreadfully boring, but you have to create sort of a higher imperative. Well, why are we doing this? We want to win hearts and minds. You know, trading partners don't go to war. There's never been a war between two countries with McDonald's in them. So it's the geopolitical imperative that gets people's attention to invest the resources in these long, terrible things. But ultimately, they are about economics. Once you get a trade agreement in place, it's about reducing transaction costs between a willing buyer and a willing seller. It takes 28 pieces of paper to export a cow. If you could make that, reduce that to 20 pieces of paper, that would make the return to the consumer and the return to the producer better. We'd have cheaper cow, you know, and cheaper and better cow. Similarly, lipstick with SPF requires, 100 pages of documentation. Let's make that easier since Canadian lips and American lips pretty darn similar and the sun is not that different either. So the effect of a trade agreement really is economic. There are just no sort of, geopolitical imperatives. If there are, they can't be enforced. It's hard enough to enforce, the commitments on lentils and beans. But you're right, geopolitics gets our attention and it delivers economic benefits. What we have to be careful about in the social realm is to make sure these economic benefits go to everybody. The NAFTA was negotiated with a lot of input from big companies, but not a lot of input from small and medium-sized enterprises. I want to get those guys back to the table and say, how do I get 25 pieces of paper down to 20 pieces of paper to export my muffler? And so making it more inclusive to small and medium-sized businesses, taking advantage of small businesses that are now able to use e-commerce to get a product across borders or digital services so you can export around the world, that's what's really important and, delivers a strong social dividend through a trade agreement. And I like your Canadian motto.
Matt.
Canada doesn't have a deficit or a surplus. Canada is pretty even ante. Am I correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, my real question... Well,
yeah, okay. So Canada has a trade... the U.S. has a trade surplus with Canada if you don't count oil. But once you put oil in it, it puts it in a deficit position. But Wilbur Ross has said it's a special deficit and it doesn't bother him.
But my real question is, which I was always been wondering about, how was it ever possible to get this highly subsidized corn into Mexico, which really did them a lot of harm because it ruins their farmers? How was that ever possible right at the beginning? How was that negotiated? I mean, you know how upset they get about having things subsidized.
You want to take a stab at that? Take a little stab at that. Subsidies. Subsidies are the bane of all of us, especially in trade. All you need to do is go to your, do we still have Max Milk stores? Your 7-Eleven and pick up a gallon of Canadian milk and think of the subsidies that are in that thing. Now, Canada is maybe less evil because Canada doesn't export its highly subsidized products, sort of, kind of, maybe. But everybody's got subsidies. And yes, the U.S. has so many agricultural programs and distortions, it boggles the mind. They are highly subsidized, but they are also very clever about making sure that they meet the trade rules as well. But here's something. Isn't it easier to deliver social policy through social mechanisms, through direct social transfers? In Mexico, there were a lot of distortionary products, programs pre-NAFTA in the corn sector for Campesino. There were price floors on tortillas. There were huge subsidies for Mexican corn growers. And that was a way to help the campesinos, to help the poor people. That when the Mexicans, and I swear to you this is true, I've heard this from the Canadian negotiator, when the Mexicans went to the NAFTA table, they said, please ask for our corn subsidies. We can't afford to support this program anymore. And so Canada and the U.S. said, you know, we could wait on this. You know, we understand that you get, you know, it's a sensitive sector. No, we can't afford to pay for this anymore. Take it away. And so they got to blame the U.S. and Canada for twisting their arm on corn subsidies. But they also replaced the corn distortionary programs with direct cash, what's called conditional cash transfer programs in Mexico that have actually worked pretty well. And the conditions are you get your kids vaccinated, you send your kids to school, you meet certain conditions, and we're going to give you this money directly rather than funnel that support through a bushel of corn.
I think you said it all. Subsidies are the bane, and they're terribly difficult domestically to deal with. The best way to do it too is to dismount them as part of a trade negotiation, so that you can say, we are doing this, yes, you, but there are those other benefits. You have something to weigh it off. Gives you the political cover. The corn is a perfect example. The Mexican would have loved to do it before they bound their own. It made no sense what they were doing. But politically, it was too difficult to do. But if you throw it in as part of NAFTA, and if you're getting huge access to the whole North American market, then it's a political pain that everybody's willing to accept.
Sir.
Okay, yeah, we have to trade for bananas and oranges and pineapples. Why do we have to trade for cars and furniture and clothing?
Woohoo! 1965 Auto Pact and the invention of the automatic transmission, because it's just too darned expensive. We need the benefits of scale. We need large enough markets that we have access to in order to afford to build plants to do advanced manufacturing. You just can't build a plant in Manitoba to build highly sophisticated machinery that you only sell to Canadians. You need to be able to sell that stuff worldwide if you're going to have that plant in Manitoba and if you're going to have that machine in Canada. So if you are Canada and you're 34 million people stretched out along this huge landmass, you've got to trade, you've got to be able to export your products to the rest of the world. And in order to allow your products to go in, you have to let other products go out, you have to let other products go in. And that's not a bad thing either, because I've got this advanced manufacturing plant in Manitoba. I'm making really cool They make electric buses, don't they? Bluebird buses. Mm. They need to get their parts from someplace else at lower prices without high tariffs. So it's a little bit of this and a little bit of that. We got to trade. If you're the U.S., you actually don't have to trade as much because you can source so much locally. But if you're small, you have to trade. Anybody want to debate?
Beautifully said.
Going to go to Winnipeg and make some buses now.
Hello, I'm Tashini, the photographer for the night. But I have a question about defense and the military-industrial complex. We know that defense is usually exempt from trade agreements. So in the case of NAFTA, and Canada's defense industry is very small. It's quite small to medium enterprises mostly, and a lot of kind of, if you want to call it, branch plants from bigger companies that are from the U.S. So I was wondering if there are any effects in regards to NAFTA around that right now, even if they normally defense is exempt from trade agreements, and what those possible, what can we see in the sense, because Canada does export a lot under the, I forgot the name of the agreement specifically, between Canada and the U.S. regarding defense.
That is a Conrad question if I've ever heard one. Tell me about defense trade, Conrad.
Can you repeat the question? I'm sorry. So
how are production of military products covered in trade agreements? Is that covered in NAFTA?
No. There's a specific exemption for things national security. There are, of course, procurement provisions, and then there are specific provisions as to what procurements are covered or not. What the Americans are now trying to do is expand the things that fall under military agreement and therefore are not subject to it. But by and large, military, anything that is security and can be classified as security is not subject to the NAFTA agreement. We have special side agreements with the Americans, especially on defense production and defense sharing agreement and that sort of thing. But it is one of the ways in which the Americans, especially in the aerospace, can subsidize their industry without it being seen as a subsidy. I mean, for example, helicopters, which John and I spent hours on. You develop a military helicopter, then you have a civilian version. Well, all the research, et cetera, goes on the military side. So, in fact, the military paid for the development of this thing, and you then sell the commercial version without essentially very few production research and production costs. And what has happened? The military sale subsidizes the civilian one, but there's nothing you can do about it because the whole thing is not part of the agreement, free trade agreement.
Now, the way you said military-industrial complex, I'm gathering you're not a real big fan of this sector of the economy, but I'll tell you something that's kind of interesting. Canada will never be an independent leader in the manufacturing of most types of security products, shall we say, because the U.S. does not want to buy things that they haven't themselves manufactured or certain types of technologies just can't cross the border. But because Canada is such a trusted partner through NORAD, Canada gets a lot more of this kind of work than other countries in the world do. And interestingly, on those products that are really difficult to import and export, the U.S. government takes a role and is the sort of buyer or seller of record to make this work out.
I'm not sure which of you two ladies is first. But.
I mean, I know my question is a little bit about issues that were at the fore a few years, the original negotiations. But what happened to all discussions about water and cultural industries?
You're just looking right at me, like I wasn't just in Chapters the other day, spending a lot of money on Heather's wonderfully subsidized books. Water. Let's start with water. I used to take a lot of flack for water. Water is in the trade agreement because it's there because it is something that can be listed in a customs code. So water in bottles, water in various vessels is actually there. So anybody says, no, water's not in the agreement, it's there. But we have all sorts of other kinds of rules, regulations, and provisions that deal with the stewardship and the movement and transfer of water that aren't in the trade agreement, but that reduce the rights of people to trade water. So you've got to jump a lot of other fences before you could even start to talk about bulk water exports. And we used to talk about that a lot in the 80s and 90s. It was a really big deal. But you know what? It's actually cheaper. It was, may not be, but I believe it is. It's actually cheaper to desalinate water than it is to move it, move bulk water from point A to point B in a bladder, or in a frozen iceberg, etc. Pipelines can be cost effective, but pipelines, as we know, have their own sorts of problems. So as long as the economics of bulk water transfers aren't there, and as long as there's all of these other regulatory impediments outside of trade agreements that prevent the movement of water, I don't think we're going to see it anywhere. Cultural industries. I think that we are in a different era on cultural industries with digital. Hey, he used to be the CRTC guy. he's going to have this one. But Canada had a whole lot of cultural protections in the first trade agreements. These cultural protections are being reduced, not because we're silly fish that are being beaten down by the Americans, but I think we're focusing in on those things that should be protected and defended, and not being quite so worried about ordering books online that come from the United States into Canada. Mr. Sarah,
on the first, on the water, the agreement applies to bottled water and stuff like that. It doesn't apply to running water. There is a provision in the agreement that the parties can agree on a joint interpretation should there be any doubt. And there is actually a joint interpretation by the minister saying that water does not is not covered by the NAFTA. So that thing has been just put to the bed. When you start dealing with it as a commercial good, you know, you're selling it through pipelines, et cetera, then it whole different issues become. But running water, et cetera, so is not covered. Cultural industry, we have a cultural exemption in the free trade agreement, which was put in the NAFTA. It still applies, etc. As Laura said, it's a bit out of date because it did deal. I mean, it's okay in terms of what it deals with, but it was on from a time when basically the culture was a good. Whether it was a book, a film, or something that you could consume. Now that you're doing streaming most people watch things over the internet. All of this doesn't really isn't germane. You have, and so the debate has moved over to copyright. You know, how do we enforce copyright? Who can do it? Etc. And the Americans are very much in favor of protecting copyright people, but they want, of course, free export of their goods to us. We have certain restrictions which we have on the retransmission, on the ownership, etc. And they are all listed in here as being issues that they want to revisit. Where we come out, who knows? I presume we will modernize and we'll try to deal with it from the Canadian point of view, protect our industry, but make it appeal also to appear or be applicable to modern means of communication, modern means of exchanging things. But the Americans are coming, they are looking at it. This is a product. This is an entertainment product. This is a business. And let's make sure that the business owner are protected for their product, and so therefore copyright, and that's for our emphasis. This is going to be very interesting negotiation, but it's not quite clear where it comes on. I have no idea what the Canadian position is, and the American position is basically focused primarily, this is a product, make sure we can export it to you without any barriers.
And just a final funny story about cultural products is we all start out with good intentions to protect culture. I don't think there was anyone who was nefarious, but you always got to follow the money and see who's going to sort of distort this stuff. And for my sins, I watched all 100 hours of USTR stakeholder consultations. So the thing about the Americans, they're very transparent. You can watch and read everything. And there were two or three references to Canada in that whole 100 hours. And the one main one was the US NFL, National Football League. And they are really aggrieved. Do you know why they're aggrieved? Because When the when the Super Bowl goes across the border, we've got the simultaneous. We used to have the simultaneous. Did you take that away? Was that you?
My successor.
You didn't do that. Okay. They used to have simultaneous substitution of the commercials, so that as soon as it hit the border, they put in a commercial for Canadian Tire rather than the really funny ones we were all watching online. And somebody, not Conrad, said that's dumb. Everybody's watching these online anyway. Let's let Canadians watch the American commercials. So the NFL is not aggrieved because what they're aggrieved about is because they had two markets before. They used to be able to sell one set of commercials to their American customers and a different set of commercials in Canada. Now they've lost that second Canadian commercial market, and it's, you know, restraint of trade, and it's so good intention about culture. Now it's about Super Bowl commercials, and now it's about
this decision. It's just. I don't understand it. The CRTC roles, which is whatever, is to protect Canadian culture and to make sure that Canada is reflected to Canadians.
Why do
you have to change the rules so that Canadians can watch U.S. commercials? I just completely has absolutely nothing to do with that. I'm not surprised the NFL is mad as hell because it costs about $200 million.
And it is discrimination. They're the only company that has been targeted in this way. They have a case.
One final question.
Okay, I know it's 9 p.m. and we're trying to keep to time, so I'll keep it very short. We've talked a lot about what the U.S. can do to transmit its message, what Trump's rationale is for driving this trade agreement forward. Is it political? Is it economic? Is it some kind of international message? I'm wondering if you can speak to a little bit what the Canadian imperative is. We're looking forward to the G7 in June 2018 and then a season of federal campaigning. How can the various federal political parties translate the benefits of trade writ large to the Canadian population and bring the technicalities out of it to make people realize the value?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that the federal parties, I'm not going to talk about the NDP because I don't know them, but the Conservatives and the Liberals are really recognizing that this is a period of crisis, that Donald Trump is not the opposition in Canada. Donald Trump is a really challenging foreign entity to be reckoned with, and if you don't deal with him correctly, it is going to have real material and security implications for Canada. So I've been very impressed by the way that, through Ron Ambrose, the conservatives have really backed up the liberal view. And when I see Canadians in Washington, and I see a lot of Canadians in Washington these days, they are, whatever party they are, they're completely aligned, which is really, really impressive, and it's great messaging for the Americans. And then the provinces come, and Kathleen Wynne, Brad Wall, they travel with, you know, federal representatives, and they're doing a great external set of messaging. Internally, I don't know how you sell free trade agreements to Canadians in 2017. I mean, the economic logic is there. As I said, there's all sorts of ways they could be improved, but the economic logic for keeping them in place is there. We actually don't need a whole lot out of a new NAFTA. We've kind of ate through that box of cereal. The new gains are in other markets that we're not trading with yet. And so I think that's why the minister is introducing the gender and First Nations elements, and good for her. And I don't know, have the NDP released a position on trade? They used to be fiercely anti-trade, and then they adopted a, we like trade, just not any agreements Canada has. I don't know where they're going now. Somebody who lives here?
I think it's obvious that it was on any political party's agenda to renegotiate NAFTA, mm-hmm. So it's purely a defensive proposition. I've never heard anybody saying, you know, NAFTA needs to be in trip proof, we have to start negotiations, there are great deficiencies here. It was a well-working agreement, a bit aged, but so our decision, this position, as far as I know, is purely defensive.
Indeed. Sir, is the final question.
I have a question. It's in French, if possible.
I don't speak French well enough to translate.
Je voulais juste parler sur l'accord entre Mexique et les États-Unis pour l'exportation des maïs est-ce que quelles solutions que l'État doit, que l'État américain doit entreprendre pour éradiquer ces fléaux néfastes? Est-ce que Donald Trump va-t-il régler les problèmes des exportations de maïs entre les États-Unis et Mexique?
If I got it, it was the question between mainly the Canadian, Mexican, American, and the export challenges, the issues with corn specifically.
Yeah.
I thought that was tackled.
Yeah.
Well, I told you everything I know about corn.
Qu'est-ce que votre question? Je ne suis pas sûr qu'est-ce que vous voulez savoir.
Je voulais juste une petite détail parce que lorsque ils ont parlé en anglais, je n'ai pas entendu, je n'ai pas cherché ça et puis juste je voulais comprendre quoi.
Laura dit que l'accord de l'ALENA est de grand avantage pour les Américains parce que maintenant ils peuvent exporter des maïs au Mexique sans tarif. Auparavant, on a eu une tarif de 150%. Et une fois qu'on n'a pas une ALENA, naturellement, cet avantage n'existe plus et les marchés mexicains vont être effectivement fermés ou barrés pour les Américains. Ça veut dire que tous les sénateurs, tous les politiciens et dans les États qui produisent les maïs vont être contre la termination des ALENA.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go on the road together.
Do a song and dance team. I'd like to say one thing before we conclude, and that I'd like to say that we've got a Canadian working for an American institution who's talking to us about Canadian-American trade. We've got an American working for a Canadian institution who's talking about how we should deal with the negotiation. And we've got a German who's told us how it all works. I think this is Canada. You've got to love this.
Thank you, Sam. That was well summarized. I don't think none of us will do justice to summarize today's very rich indeed experience, but what I got out of it, that Canada, with all its representation, as Sam mentioned, we do have a rich experience in negotiating with the U.S. and other partners. Obviously, we do have a very rich experience indeed, and it looks like we will be plowing through this experience as well. Obviously, NAFTA is very important to us for jobs, for Canadians, and at the end of the day, it will remain an important negotiation. And finally, obviously, the whole dynamics between Mexico, U.S., Canada, Canada, U.S., and that dynamics, it looks like it will be playing out as well. We would like to thank you and our students from the Master's Class of Public and International Affairs have a small gift to the panelists and the moderator. We would like to thank you profusely. And I also would like to thank the audience for your participation. And one more round of applause for this. Very quickly, many people to thank. Firstly, of course, the translators, interpreters in the booth there. Thank you. I would like to thank the students who came, and most importantly, the organizers of tonight's evening. It is specifically with Marion and Teshini. It was a three-person team organizing this one. We thank you very much. We have two upcoming events, and I would like to mention to this audience that our next two upcoming events on January 18th and March 22nd, we will be looking at the whole issue of global populism and global migration. And actually, some of our panelists are here in the audience. As well. Please return your écouteurs. I thank you again, the panelists and the audience and everyone for participating. Bonne nuit, bonne chance, et puis on se verra à la prochaine. Merci infiniment.
I can see it.